Welcome to the Herd Quitter Podcast. I'm your host, Jared Lumen. On this show, we talk to farmers and ranchers who aren't afraid to think for themselves and do things a little bit differently. We hope these guests will challenge you to look at your farms and ranches in a new way and result in a more profitable and enjoyable business for you and your family. Hello and welcome back to the Herd Quitter Podcast. Today's episode is with another guy named Jared Sorensen. He's a rancher from out west and host of the Profitable Steward podcast, I believe, and founder of Ag Steward and a bunch of different kind of programs that he puts out. He'll talk about at the end of this podcast that are definitely worth checking out. Some online webinars, conference summits type events and podcast and YouTube videos and things. Lots of good stuff he's putting out, so worth checking out for sure. I have to apologize right off the bat. I think it happened maybe two times throughout this conversation where my computer said internet unstable, and the guest, in this case, Jared Sorensen, it happened on a couple other podcasts I've recorded lately here too that will come out in the next few weeks, but where like maybe 10 seconds, maybe 5 or 10 seconds, it felt like a long time, but it probably wasn't that long, 5 or 10 seconds of just the guest's audio not coming through. So I apologize for that if it seems like all of a sudden it skipped ahead a little bit. I think it maybe happened two times in this episode where there was a little bit of a gap, and I cut that audio out, or that, so you're not just listening to 10 seconds or whatever of a blank space, but it will maybe not quite feel like it flows quite right. So I apologize for that. I don't know what's going on with my internet. Hopefully that gets worked out here shortly. So again, apologies. But before we dive into that episode, I wanted to tell you a little bit about today's show sponsor, Barn to Door. Barn to Door is a solution built for independent farmers that my wife and I actually use to grow and manage our direct farm business. We use them for all of our inventory and sales and customer management. But recently, Barn to Door actually rebranded their podcast to the Independent Farmer Podcast. And so if you're a person who loves listening to podcasts like this, or like me, I love listening to podcasts, tune in to the Independent Farmer Podcast, where they share tips from successful farmers, industry experts, and financial advisors, just to name a few. If you're looking to expand your sales and reach for your independent farm, check out the new podcast anywhere that you listen to podcasts. And to learn more about the software Barn to Door offers for independent farmers, go to www.barntodoor.com/herdquitter. If you choose to sign up, you'll get access to a free academy session. That's a $99 value. Again, the website is www.barntodoor.com/herdquitter. I'll have that link in the show notes. But now we'll dive into my conversation with Jared Sorensen. Jared, thanks so much for joining me, and welcome to the Herd Quitter Podcast.
It's your privilege to be here with you. I appreciate the good work that you're doing, and look forward to the visit here today.
Yeah. Well, we'll try to avoid confusing people too much. We both share the name Jared, and so there might be a little confusion for people, but I appreciate it. It'll be fun. You even spell it the right way, which is, I find fewer and fewer people that spell it that way, so that's good. But
yeah.
But maybe for people who aren't familiar with you and what you do, give us a little bit of an update about what you're up to now. And then when we finish that, we'll dive into your history and kind of talk about your journey to where you are today.
Okay, sounds good. Yep. So we, a little over a year ago, we started a company called Ag Steward. And we saw the need to be able to help people on their journey of regeneration. There's a lot of pioneers out there, and we love them and appreciate them. Not everybody, including myself, has the fortitude to be a pioneer. And so we started Ag Steward to be able to help people to bridge the learning gap from having the desire to become what we term now as regenerative, and not go through the trough, whether that be the production loss, even just losing the ambition to keep going. And so that's really the purpose of what Ag Steward does, is we do virtual trainings, coach people one-on-one, do on-site consulting as well. But we're pretty clear on who we help. And that is family-owned farmers and ranchers who are committed to going down the regenerative path.
Very cool. And as far as ranching, I for those who listen, I have made the second time now in 170 episodes where I've forgotten to press record right at the start. This time we only got a couple minutes in, but you had mentioned earlier, I think you mentioned third generation rancher. Is that right as well?
Yes. Yep. Third generation rancher. My grandfather started here in Nevada, moved from southern Utah to Nevada, started with sheep. And then my dad came back to the ranch after he got married. I got started in the sheep business, actually partnering with my dad at a pretty young age. I was in my teens, still in high school doing homeschool. And so I was a business partner and grateful to my grandfather for allowing me that opportunity to take his share of then the commercial sheep herd and learn a little bit more about the business side. After serving a mission and going to one semester of college, I met and married a girl that loved ranching as much as I do, and was blessed to come back. My dad asked if we would stay home for one semester of college to help ship calves and do fall work, and here we are,
Yeah,
20
never
nearly
left
28
again.
years later.
That's
So,
awesome.
and it's, we say we live happily ever after. There's a lot that happened in that 28 years, and we can
Yeah.
dive into a little bit of that, but it's been
Yeah.
quite the journey. Nine kids
Wow.
alone, and three of them are married.
That's awesome.
God is good.
Yeah, man. That's so cool. But you talked about your history, and if it's all right with you, I'd like to dive into kind of your family's history there. You talked about your grandpa starting with sheep. If as much as you know, I'm always fascinated by how ranches start and how they're carried on. I think, I don't know, a lot of us, like myself, I don't even know how many generation farmer get to, benefit from the hard work of the previous generations, and oftentimes that gets forgotten, I think. And so if it's okay with you, I'd love to, if you have anything that you know that you wouldn't mind sharing about your grandfather's start and some of the hardships he's faced and some of the learning experiences he had, and
Yeah.
talk a little bit about that, I'd sure appreciate it.
Yeah, that's good. I appreciate the question, Jared. So one of these days I'll get my dad actually on a podcast because he's 90, gonna be 90 this year. And he still has a pretty good memory, and he could cite from, facts and figures and number of head and all those things. So this is gonna be more broad strokes, but
Sure.
grandpa moved to Nevada. So when my dad was born in 1934, my grandpa was born in 1900, and he died at the age of 96. He was very active in the ranch, pretty much up until the day he died. He fell and broke his hip and didn't last long after that, but lived on his own in well into his 90s, was riding horses and still driving until, we got to the point we had to take away his keys and driver's license. But
Yeah.
so he came to Nevada with the sheep herd and started in a little bit south of here, and then moved to Elko County and took out a fairly sizable loan. So he actually built a sheep herd during the Depression. And I use that story a lot, that whenever there's adversity, there's always opportunity. And he came out of the Depression fairly wealthy as far as, net worth.
Yeah.
Not a lot of cash like a lot of farmers and ranchers, but
Sure.
was able to take that herd and use it as collateral to be able to buy a sizable sheep operation and partnered with somebody. And so I think at the high point, they ran on over 1 million acres and about 14,000 ewes and some cattle as well. And
Wow.
so when that partnership dissolved, my grandpa took the northern portion of the ranch. His partner took the southern portion, and my dad, about that time, was married and came back and stepped into the kind of the foreman role. As the sheep herd diminished, the cow herd increased. We were running on largely public land, a lot of private land interspersed, and some blocks of private land that my grandfather traded with the government to be able to block up and put together, and build an operation which was worked for a lot of years. And then, with increasing wild horse pressure, government issues, working with Bureau of Land Management, we actually sold the allotment in about around 2010 and transitioned. So we transitioned from sheep to cattle in the late 90s, and then from a cow herd to now custom grazing in 2010. And so we're just operating all on private ground. Most of it we own, some of it we lease, and have a great landlord, absentee owner, who's very conservation minded and stewardship minded. So that's kind of in a nutshell, Jared, what built it. A lot of tenacity, a lot of hard work, like all operations are built on. And we get to definitely reap where we haven't sown and reap the blessings of that work and effort.
Yeah, no doubt. I'm just kind of curious too on like the succession, if you don't mind kind of talking about it. It's kind of unique where your father was partner with his father and you bought out, you know, your grandparent kind of share, it sound like, or some sort of a transition like that. Are you willing to share that? That's kind of a unique strategy I haven't heard, but it's kind of cool, especially as young as you were.
Yeah, right. I mean, looking back, it's like, I don't know what my folks were doing and my grandparents. I mean, we kind of have two opposite ends of successions. My grandfather, as I mentioned, transferred a lot of the ownership. So fortunately, you know, in the 90s, the estate taxes and stuff were extremely high.
Sure.
They were very progressive about gifting and transferring ownership and things. And so fortunately, that had taken place. So when he died, there was minimal estate tax. Had they not done that, likely we would not have the operation that we have. So, so he lived into his 90s and really never retired. He said he just got tired. And so it contrasts that with my dad, who at 62 years old, me 22 years old, my dad and mom, after all four of my grandparents had passed away and they had cared for them, they decided they were going to go serve missions. And they asked my wife and I if we would be willing to take on management of the ranch. And again, what were they thinking? I mean, 22 years old, young family, and just a lot of ambition, but holy cow, there was so much that I didn't know about running a business. And I mean, it was painful looking back on how ignorant I was, but didn't even know it. You know, I took a lot of tuition to the what did somebody say, the University of Hard Knocks, the UHK or whatever. I paid dearly for that, but I wouldn't trade it for anything. Along the way, I've learned lessons that I couldn't have learned in any other way.
Isn't it crazy? I think that's probably super common, because I look back, I'm only 30 now, and I look back at myself even 5 years ago and I'm like, man, I thought I knew it all. I knew then a whole lot more than I did at 22 as well and stuff. And it's just funny looking back at, and I wonder, I guess I can move forward with a lot more humility knowing I probably don't know everything I think I know now. But
yeah, and that's, I mean, I guess that's kind of that old circle of ignorance and circle of knowledge. You know, as our knowledge increases, we realize that there's really so much that we don't know, but at the same time, we don't have to know it all. And that's one of the reasons that I think Ag Steward was started. Is, you know, we partner with, we joint venture, invite others on to our summits and webinars, that are repurposed as a podcast. And so I don't try to be everything to everyone, but I feel like I've been very blessed along the way to meet some amazing people who know things that I don't know and can kind of tap into their knowledge and experience.
Yeah, no, that's what I've done with this podcast. It's a pretty cool opportunity to talk to folks like you and other people that I may not talk to on a regular basis otherwise, but this becomes an opportunity to do so and to share that conversation and that information with other people. It's pretty cool. And I want to definitely get more into what you're doing with the Ag Steward. Maybe talking a little more on your ranch experience, would you mind kind of sharing the management kind of journey, as far as you talked about your regenerative journey? Did that start with you? Was your dad and your grandpa, did they always have kind of a regenerative and soil managed focus, or where did that start to pick up?
They definitely were really good stewards of the land. Their philosophy and basically you know, the mission statement that my dad shared with me when he left on his service, which extended for, you know, nearly almost 15 years, they would be home and would be gone more than they were home. And so traveled throughout the world. And so they were kind of out of pocket. I mean, it wasn't like now where I could Zoom or FaceTime or even call them. It was email. And so really found out how quickly how much I didn't know. But so kind of on my journey, I was invited to attend the Ranching for Profit School. And I think the January of 2003. And, you know, I'd kind of scoffed at holistic management before that, not knowing at all what it was about.
Sure.
But that opened my eyes that, man, there's this whole other world of taking management to. So the parents and grandparents was take good care of the land and the livestock, and they will take good care of you. And so they did the best that they knew with the knowledge that they had, and really built a good business. And all I had to do was not screw it up. And well, it only took me a few years before I did that. And then had to like learn, okay, what, you know, and granted, some of it was ignorance, some of it was circumstance changing, you know, with government policies and land and wild horses, and some things were out of my control, but definitely the management was the journey along the way. And so Ranching for Profit started that. I was blessed to meet and work with Bud Williams, and Bud and Eunice are our dear friends, and they have had a great and tremendous influence on my life. Visited the ranch, and Eunice and her daughter Tina and Richard have recently been on two separate podcasts that we've done. Privileged to have them. It's still, you know, part of our network to be able to tap into the knowledge that they've gained. And so learned about stockmanship and sell by marketing and a lot about management just from Bud and the way he saw things. And then just really started to continue to learn and realize that I transitioned from a livestock producer to a grass farmer, to a microbe farmer when I met Nicole Masters, and started to realize, wow, there's this whole world underneath our feet that I didn't even realize existed. And, you know, instead of just propping up our forage production system with fertilizer or removing, which I had done, you know, just removed all the inputs altogether and said, well, we're just going to do this with grazing. I realized that there are some other things that we can do to be able to build soil faster and promote the life in the soil. And so that kind of transitioned to more of a microbe farmer. And then from there to more of a stewarding people through Ag Steward and wanting to share the knowledge that we've gained on this journey.
Yeah. So I've heard people say kind of something like you just talked about there of, you know, who was it? I forget now. It said something about like, I love cows. Then they realized they love grass. Then they realized they needed to love the soil. It's kind of a similar thing that you're talking about, is this shift in focus and that shift in mindset. What does that actually look like in practice and on the farm in logistical, like how is your management changing as you changed your mindset from a focus on livestock production to a focus on grass production, and from a focus on grass production to a focus on microbe and biology production? Like what did that actually look like in practice and the day-to-day management of the operation?
Yeah. It's still definitely something that's evolving, and, you know, every year we change it up a little bit. We do custom graze primarily. And so it allows us a lot of adaptability of when the cattle come and how long they stay, which is really nice because, you know, early spring this time of year, and we've had 3 days of snow. We had some really warm days and the grass started and then it just stalled out. And so being able to call our custom grazing customers and say, hey, let's push it back a week. That is nice.
Yeah.
That allows for some flexibility that if we own the cow herd, it would be tough.
Sure.
So building in flexibility into our system, adaptability is super key. So we look at, you know, we we run as large of herds as we feasibly can, which is normally dictated by water, stock water. We combine anything that can be put together to make the herds large, and usually pare it down to about two herds and over two geographic locations. And sometimes we'll bounce the yearlings back and forth, and which we're going to do this year to be able to do what the Savory method says, and be at the right place at the right time for the right reasons with the right behavior of the livestock. So if you can combine those things, then you will see livestock performance, and you'll see your grasses start to improve and perennial grasses increase, which we are seeing. We are monitoring with the ecological outcome verification, with the Savory Institute, with the AVI Hub, and appreciate the work that they do in coming and monitoring on an annual basis and being able to provide some monitoring data. And we're like our fifth year into that this year. So we can kind of measure and test, and you know, we do apply compost tea, compost extract strategically on our irrigated fields. Only about 10% of our land that we own and operate is irrigated, but it produces nearly 50% of the forage. So we focus our effort where we have the highest marginal reaction. We're a lot more intensive because there's a lot more forage production intensive with the daily or multi-day moves on our irrigated pastures. And I don't think we've reached the limits, and I don't know if we ever will, but it's it's a fun journey, and try to stretch every year and learn every year. And we still have weed pressure. We still have more bare ground than we'd like to. We still have annuals and things, but the trajectory is in the right way. And, you know, nature plays the long game. If we don't get too impatient and short circuit the system, we know that progress will be made.
Yeah, absolutely. You kind of touched on two separate question lines that I'm curious about. So help me remember to come back to enterprises. You talked about custom grazing and stuff. But on the one that you are kind of talking about there now with management of, or with the improvements of soils and the intensity of managing your irrigated ground versus kind of the more vast lands. I mean, talk a little bit more about that for people who are listening that have highly productive irrigated ground. Like, what kind of management are you doing there? And then how do you just kind of say, you know, all of the rest of this dry land, grassland is kind of just, we're just going to do the same thing as we've always done? Or have you found ways to begin to implement regenerative practices to somehow, you know, at whatever scale you can to improve it?
Yeah. Super good questions. And so, you know, we look at it's not necessarily two forms of management. It's just adapted in different ways. So if you look from the Savory Institute at the brittleness scale, and on the one side you have the non-brittle environment, which would be more tropics, which would be more representative of what our irrigated land would be, versus very brittle would be high desert. And so on our uplands, we would probably be, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, on the brittleness scale, would probably be a 6. It would tend towards brittle.
Sure.
But the thing that we do have in our context, we have heavy snow. And so in brittle environments, generally the forage will break down chemically. But because of the heavy snow, it's going to lay it on the ground, and it will break down biologically, even if you don't graze it.
Sure.
So that's somewhat unique of our brittle environment. And brittleness is more to do with the moisture at the soil surface than rainfall. And so in those irrigated grounds, it is more humid at the soil surface when you're irrigating, and that humidity tends to last even throughout the year. So in that environment, we typically will graze twice during the growing season and once in the dormant season. Our recovery times are a lot quicker. So we shoot for as long as feasible, but also managing that grass so that it doesn't get too rank, so that we don't sacrifice animal performance. And we're not so worried about it letting it go to seed, is because it's going to spread more from the roots, and it's because of the diversity that we have. Whereas on a range ground, I don't know, does that kind of address the irrigated side before we move to the other side,
Jared? Yeah. So you're moving You're moving three times through the year. Is that pretty intensive as far as daily moves every couple days?
So we strive to be, no longer than 2 to 3 days, and it really depends on herd size, and we're taking our permanent fences and cross fencing, using train the cattle to poly wire electric fence. And so we have an infinite number of subdivisions and paddocks that we can put in there. And again, we're finding that these large herds, we do not have the most, and in the summertime, man, they drink a lot of water, and so you've really got to be conscious and aware of that and kind of have some backup systems. But watering out of creeks and ditches is not a very good system. It's just, you get a lot of pugging and tears up your ditches pretty bad. So we try to manage that as well, because we flood irrigate these meadows, and so it's trying to allow them to dry in between graze periods. But so yeah, to answer your question, it's pretty adaptive, anywhere from multi moves per day, but generally just balancing the workload, the grass productivity, and the needs of the animals. It's about every other day that we move. And kind of our rule of thumb is the rule of the thirds on that irrigated. Third goes for the above ground critters, a third goes for the below ground critters and gets tromped, and then we leave a third as a photosynthetic solar panels to be able to photosynthesize and get more rapid regrowth.
Interesting. Yeah, I've not actually heard that third. I've always heard that, take half, leave half. But yeah, and there's not, I mean, not really a specific, you're not able to probably uniformly, take a third of each. I mean, it's kind of just an average across the field. There's stuff out there that's still growing and photosynthesizing, obviously roughly a third gone and a third trampled, but it's not like the take half, leave half. I've always struggled with, specifically in our context with diverse kind of improved species and whatnot that we've got, is it seems like definitely the cows prefer some to others. And so it's more like take 90% of one and take 10% of another, and it averages, taking half, leaving half, but you've got some overgrazing and some undergrazing, which is difficult to manage for. But how does that look, I guess, somehow getting that third?
About the only way to do that we've found is to tighten up your graze period so that there's an element of competition. And so if you're giving them more than about 2 days worth, they're going to be too selective and they're not going to trample enough, and they will overgraze certain plants. So they have to be, kind of that kid at the buffet where he's getting pushed around and hurry up through the line and just eat whatever you can, weeds and undesirables and some of the candy and dessert at the end of the table as well. But so that and again, we're questioning, if we move to multi moves per day, will we see an increase? Will it be worth it? So far, we haven't. Like, every other day seems like a good balance for us. But I'm definitely, open, and if it's going to grow more grass and we're going to put more pounds on cattle, then yeah, we would push that. So
I've always wondered that where that line is too, like that law of diminishing returns. At what point does your labor no longer justify the benefits, no longer justify the labor to increase that management? And it's, yeah, it seems like different people have different perspectives on it. And I guess everybody has to find what works for them in their context, I guess.
I think that's a lot of it too. What are you willing to do? What are you set up to do? But I would say definitely don't be afraid to try and, push the envelope. And we've had wrecks and stuff before, where they've stayed too long, and like everybody, where they've run short on water and stuff like that. So, you've got to, I appreciate the management side of it. As Jim Gerrish says, it's management intensive grazing, because it is the management. That's what needs to be intensive. Not everybody thinks, well, we got to be intensive on the ground. And yeah, there's a place for that, within the right context. Yeah, maybe you really do want to get some really good herd effect and even setback succession, restart succession in certain areas, if it's brushy or whatever. But that's a good point. the law of diminishing returns. For us, that seems about every other day.
No, that makes sense. Yeah, I like it. And if there's nothing on that, then yeah, moving to the kind of the uplands or drylands, whatever you kind of refer to those at, what does the management look like there?
Yeah. So there we are generally once over during the growing season, and we all season of use. So we strive to never be in the same pasture at the same time of year, 2 years in a row. And then we'll roll in a full season of rest about every 3 to 5 years for these upland pastures. So challenging 16,000 acres of pretty steep, rugged country that's not fenced. And so we've always tried, well, I shouldn't say always, but, you know, since I started working with Bud Williams, I thought, man, we can herd these cattle. We can do this. And, you know, we just, our skill level is not there to be able to do that currently. You know, Bob Kinford was on our last summit, and Don Otto's been to our ranch, and Bud's been to our ranch, and I no doubt that they could do it. Our skill level is not there. And so we've done some single strand electric fence. That's mostly what we do for our interior fences now, and good energizer and good grounding and all that. So that it works even in the dry season most of the time.
Yeah.
And then we're just striving to use it as intensely as possible and then stay off and really have long recovery periods. This year we're experimenting with virtual fencing. I'm experimenting on a fairly decent scale. You know, 800 cows are going to be collared here by the end of the month. And so we're, I was very skeptical and even kind of thought it was like being a heretic after, you know, working with Bud and those guys and thinking, man, technology has a place, but is this the place? But talking with some large scale ranchers from Southern Utah and seeing the success that they had both from livestock management and ecology, that's, to me, it's like, okay, we can maybe be a little bit humble and try this. And I shouldn't say try it. I mean, we're committed. We're going to work because, you know, it's just like electric fence.
Yeah.
There's people that say, oh, that'll never work. And they're right. They'll prove themselves right. So we are going to work out the bugs and we'll get this system working.
Yeah. Well, I was very skeptical about it at first as well. And then I went to a field day in Minnesota where they had kind of the custom goat grazing for hire type crews. Well, there was this one particular crew that was like running goats with collars with no fence in urban settings in woods. And it was working successfully. And it was just, I saw it and it was phenomenal.
Yeah.
I was like, wow. Well, then my next skepticism was like pricing. And I'm curious what you think on that. I mean, for you in that, I think you said 16,000 acres, like infrastructure and fence and water, like that kind of infrastructure is going to be very costly as well. So how does this compare to investing in infrastructure? And I don't want to make you share specific numbers too, if that's not something you're comfortable with, but I'm just curious how the financials of this look in your context.
Yeah, that is a fairly big barrier. You know, you've got the capital one-time cost of the towers, and we're going to take three of those to be able to get the coverage that we need, and then $40 per head for the collars annual cost, and $10 for the annual cost for the batteries. And and you know, we're only having these cattle here for 6 months during the season, so how do we justify that? We've had, we struggle getting cattle gathered on time and even getting them all found. Sure. And so we kind of had to do, you know, an analysis and say, yeah, the one-time cost for the towers, we realized we're going to have to amortize that basically like any capital improvement. Yeah. The annual cost, we just looked at, you know, how many cattle could we stand to lose before we can justify this. And so that's kind of the way that we looked at it. We are also, Kateri Carbon has been one of our sponsors for our summit. And so they have a program where it minimizes the upfront cost and basically comes out of on the back end on the carbon payment side.
Okay.
And so as part of that, that's what we're involved with as well.
Sure.
And so that that helps on the annual costs of the collars. And basically, then we share the cost of the battery with the cattle owner. So it's, we'll, you know, I guess ask me in a year, Jared, and see.
I
I mean,
will. I will if
because
you're open
that's,
to it. I'm very curious about how it works. And
yeah.
so
And
the
I shouldn't
power.
say a year. I mean, 6 months, we'll know, because
Yeah.
we ship the cattle out in December, you know, November and December. So.
Let's definitely follow up on that. I'm very curious to see what that looks like. It seems like in my mind, there's like a couple places where that kind of investment makes sense. And I think of that in your context, where like you've got this vast space where the financial infrastructure is just too great. And then in my context, like if you can put large contiguous groups together, there's no way the fence beats it and your labor cost is so low. But a lot of pastures around here are the 20, 30, 40 acres that the crop guys can't farm. So you got 10 cows there, 15 cows over here. And to try and move them daily and you're running across eight farms trying to move pastures for 10 cows, like the labor costs just get too high then. And so I thought it could maybe work there to manage those smaller pastures. And so, yeah, I'm optimistic about it as a whole if the cost can get affordable. And I know there's a couple different places that are companies that are doing it with different cost structures. And it sounds like Vence is the one. I think theirs is that tower model. And so then is it kind of a lease, annual lease on the collars? And like, I think no fences, you buy the collars and they're expected to have 5, 7 year life period. And then you have to rebuy them. But with yours, is it essentially a leased collar?
It is, yeah. So there we're working with Vance on that side as well.
Yeah.
And so Kateri, basically they need to be able to have hard data that shows that you're actually have somewhat of a management plan and
Sure.
not just turn them out and leave them for the whole season.
Yeah.
And it's pretty open. I mean, basically they adopted the plan that we have, which we're striving to be more intensive. And this will allow us to be able to even step up that even more.
Yeah.
You know, we probably won't be on daily moves for sure. It'll probably be more like 7 day. You
Sure.
know, 7 to 10 days to optimize the life of the battery
I
in
see.
the collars.
Yeah.
And then also, you know, we just don't know that we would necessarily see the benefit of daily moves, but we're going to experiment with it and see
Yeah.
this year, you know, in some
Cool.
strategic areas. And then also we have larkspur on this range ground. And so that'll allow us to exclude some areas as well.
Sure.
And so certain areas like we couldn't turn out in until August because of the larkspur patches.
Yeah.
So it'll get some flexibility to where we can change up season of use in those areas as well while not killing cattle.
That
So
makes sense. Yeah. Nope. That's cool. I'm excited. We'll definitely have to follow up on that because I think that man, if the technology can get cheaper, I've seen it work and I'm very impressed with its ability to work. If it can get to where it makes sense financially at scale, then I think they're definitely gonna be popular. But I guess a question I've had too, am I correct in you work with some private, some leased land, quite a bit of public land?
yeah, so no more, not very much public land
Okay.
anymore. You know, we had a 500,000 acre allotment
Okay.
when we had our cow herd, and again sold that in 2010.
Okay.
So just a little bit of Forest Service, and then about 12,000 acres that we leased from a private landowner.
Okay. Sure.
Yeah.
So the question around that then, I guess, and maybe it's not so relevant anymore, is how does working with some of those public landowners, working with your management, I've heard some people say that it's super difficult to try and get any sort of management plans because they have their way of doing things and it just can be difficult. But I guess, do you feel you have much to share on that with if most of what you're doing is private, or we can move on if that's not something you have too much to share on that topic?
Yeah, I can just touch on it for a minute. So I
Sure.
was asked to speak in Southern Utah recently, and most of the ranches down there are have a public land component. And we're talking like, you know, hundreds of thousands of acres
Yeah.
to run not that many cattle.
Yeah.
It's even more deserty than we are. And so it was neat to see that the agencies were the one who had organized and co-organized this event that they invited me to speak at. And that's where the people who had experimented with the virtual fencing, they also spoke. And so they're pretty progressive. And so I think as we are seeing this shift in which all paradigms take a generation dying off before the paradigm really breaks and changes, it's cool to see that that's happening. Because we have these ranch kids who maybe, for whatever reason, there wasn't a place for all of them to come back to the ranch, and they are now the ones who are going back to agencies. And they're the range cons. They're the ones who are pushing as hard as the ranchers to be able to be more progressive, progressive in the sense of, let's tighten things up. Let's actually change. Let's have some season of use here, and let's provide some rest. So that's neat to see, at least in that part. I know there's, it really depends on the area that you're in and the management team that's involved there. But certainly AG Smith here in Elko County is one who is a leader who's collaborated with different agencies, including the BLM Forest Service, Department of Wildlife, and is doing some amazing things through some pretty ad having gone through some pretty adverse circumstances, which, I don't know if I would have put up with it. Like, he has a ton of patience and very much views the long game, and he's been successful at it. And he's also doing virtual fencing and has this their support because, he's been able to restore riparian areas and beavers are coming back into the landscape, and it's just pretty cool, by any measure, that things are regenerating and success is happening.
Love that. That's awesome. I've heard, the range of it. So I'm glad to hear that some people are starting to come around. I'm even seeing it here in Minnesota, which is exciting to see. But the other question, well, I guess, is there anything more on kind of your land management? I know you probably could talk for days on land management, but any other highlights kind of on specifically your transition and your regenerative journey as far as your management, what the things you've been doing are to improve your land and soil?
Yeah, it's definitely a journey that, every year we're learning, every year we're failing and trying new things. So I think what is the next level? At some point, maybe you need to not be complacent and say good is good enough, but you always have to have, like you mentioned, that diminishing returns question in mind. But I don't know that we know what the capacity of this land is yet. And so a good friend of mine, Josh Adams, has spoken on some of our events. And so working with him and taking balancing science with the art of and craft of ranching and farming, that's kind of where I see it. Science being that, okay, you can take compost teas and compost extracts and strategically apply them and see that you can transition from the chemical treadmill to a regenerative practice with zero chemicals without the yield loss. And so that's even though we're not big time farmers, I think that's, to me, that's super exciting, the what that holds. And so I always like to go first and say, okay, if it's going to work, I want to prove it. And so that's kind of what we're looking at, is really stepping that up.
Nope, that makes sense. Cool. A lot there's a lot of stuff. I feel like well, I've fortunately, hopefully still have a lot of a career left, but the things that I will be able to do or to learn based on the knowledge that will be learned over the next 10, 20, 30 years at the end of my career is I'm interested or excited to see what that looks like. So
Yeah, that's true.
but I wanted to get back to you talked about the enterprise. You mentioned the family kind of starting sheep. You've talked about a cow-calf herd, talked about custom grazing. Maybe just talk a little bit in general about the different enterprises you've had, the pros, cons of each, and why you've kind of fallen into the enterprise mix that you have today.
And that's definitely still a journey, Jared. Custom grazing provides a lot of flexibility. We talked a little bit about this in the summit with Roger Savory, that there's pros and cons. It's not always, the most profitable. And right now, when everybody's selling $1,500 calves. I'm like, dang, where did we go wrong? But also last year when everybody was losing calves to blizzards in April and buying $300 a ton hay to get through the winter, we looked pretty smart. And so, yeah, where is that balance? Our real heart lies in grass finishing cattle. And so we do direct market some. We've sold into branded beef companies, and that's what I, that is the direction that we want to head, is to be able to change up a system whereby we're not reliant upon subsidies and a degenerative practice is producing corn and soy to be able to fatten cattle. And granted, I know that we can't change overnight, but I think at some point the wheels are going to fall off of the system that we have, and we need to have enough people who have the skill level to be able to finish cattle and forage, so that we can continue to feed our population. And I think that there's a lot of people that are doing that. There's a lot of people that are direct marketing. Some of them are profitable, some of them aren't. How can we make that profitable is my question, and kind of one of those things that we're putting a lot of effort into, both ourselves and also for our clients, because we have the resource base to be able to finish, 600 to 800 head a year, on average.
Sure.
And so, but we don't have the market, and then there's a lot of aspects to that, as I know the marketing side of it, and the fulfillment side, and all of that, it's great, cut out the middleman until you're the middleman, and then you realize, okay, that's why they get paid so doggone much, because
Yes, absolutely. No.
yep.
So do you see a way forward to deal with that challenge? Because I think that you're right. That is the biggest reason why people aren't doing it is the, well, it seems to me anyway, a lot of the wholesale markets for grass-finished beef are not really that profitable. You're almost better off just backgrounding and raising to a
Yeah.
certain weight to do all the hassle expertise that is required to finish beef on grass, and then the premium you get just to sell it wholesale to some other market, it just doesn't seem worth it for a lot of people.
Yeah, I don't know the, but I believe that so reading Dan Sullivan's book, Who Not How. We need to start asking better questions of like, who has the skills that I don't have? Because I have no desire to go and stand at farmers markets and, sell beef at that level. I applaud the people that do and definitely support the local side of it. But if we're going to do it at scale and actually have a viable business, we've got to think, 10 times or 50 times different. And find that balance between the production model that we currently have with a grass-based local model, and to be able to do it without working ourselves to death, and also without having our hand in the government's pocket to, subsidize us. So the who's specifically that we're looking for, people that understand the marketing. Cam King is great, and he's helped a lot of individuals to be able to build businesses that will actually support family.
Who is that?
So Cam King from Grass Fed Marketing Secrets, or he
Ah, yes.
rebranded as Farm Rebel.
Okay.
Really, really good that we're going to make this publicly available here probably this week. But we did an interview with him for our summit. It was the only pre-recorded interview because we couldn't match him up to speak live, and it was titled Why God Wants Ranchers to Be Profitable. And so we kind of dived into that, why, and I won't spoil it, and encourage you to go look it up on our YouTube channel, The Profitable Ag Steward. That's the best place. It's probably will later be released on the podcast, but so the marketing aspect of it definitely is important. I applaud the people who are starting these smaller USDA plants. That is a tough one. We've had extensive conversations with Alan Williams, and I know that COVID changed some things, but basically he said it's not till the third owner that those things start making money. And I think that's probably true. You remove the subsidies and the grants and stuff like that, I don't think they could cash flow. And so it's tough to say, well, let's go build more of these things because, dang, that's not a real sustainable model. So I have way more questions, Jared, than I have answers, but that is the weak link there. Distribution, I think we can tackle that one. You know, we've got the ability to be able to distribute beef nationwide and get it to people's doors frozen. That part, at least until an infrastructure breakdown or something unforeseen, you know, happens, we're good on that end. So marketing and processing are probably the biggest weak links that I see. And I think there are people out there who, you know, if we don't have to be the one-stop shop to answer all the questions, I think we can do that working with the strategic people. So I'd love to hear what other people are doing. We have some contacts and we're definitely, you know, kind of chomping at the bit to be able to finish cattle. But like you said, yeah, we've had cattle contracts, verbal agreements in place. Yeah, we'll buy your cattle, and then the company has a structure change and no, we can't buy your cattle. And so it's like we want to learn from these experiences and go into it using, I don't know, the best knowledge and skills that are available, I think. Because you're doing it, what change would have to happen to have like a tipping point where forage produced, and I mean, I'm not talking from a health side benefit. We can all argue that is grain fed or grass fed better. I'm looking at a sustainability side, and if you had to pay the full price for corn and soy, you couldn't feed it to cattle on a caloric basis. It takes more calories to produce it than it gives off. And so somewhere that's being subsidized, somewhere we're paying the price. When we have to pay that price, there's going to be a shift. And I'd be curious to know what you think on that.
Well, that's a good question. And I know they talk about the externalized costs of grain production and a lot of these different forms of production and stuff. I mean, and that's part of it. I mean, one thing that I struggle with is the thing that at the end of the day, the majority of people right now anyway, tend to be cost shoppers and value shoppers, and we can't compete with the scale. We can't compete with the scale and keep our costs low. I mean, I just look at my business model, and I'm competing against someone that, you know, is hauling potloads of cattle to a feedlot, feeding out thousands of head of cattle, bringing them to a processor that does 1,000 head a day and ships out semi loads of beef, and I'm hauling 5 to 10 head on my little pickup truck to an 80 head a day processor, and just hauling 2 pallets on a semi to a cold storage place where I, you know, then haul pallets to my freezer space, and it's like so inefficient. My cost is so high, and the reason that I can afford to, or the reason that I can get away with charging the price that I have, is because of the relationship that I have with my customer. They're buying my story, they're buying that relationship, and they recognize that that price is reflected in like that relationship, and that they know that that is a different pr it's a really is a different product. They're not just buying meat, they're buying a story and a relationship with someone. And to get the scale to be able to compete with any sort of a commodity, even if it's 100% regeneratively raised in all the right ways, to get that scale, you start to give up the story and the personal relationship, I feel like. And so I always wonder, like, so you can't charge that premium anymore, maybe, that it costs, because you've lost that story and that relationship. I don't know. It's a big struggle, challenge thing that I don't know what the future of it looks like. I don't have an answer.
Yeah, maybe it starts with asking the right questions, and if nothing else, that's what we can do here is say that, you know, we don't have the answers, but I encourage people to look down the road and to say, okay, is this model going to work long term? And right now, you know, it's hard to argue. Well, it's not really hard to argue. I mean, I keep referring to these people that are in our contact list. So Doug Ferguson, who now teaches sell by marketing, great guy, and he and I visit periodically. He's been on some of our events, and you know, he says record high cattle prices, and he gets calls regularly about people who can't make loan payments, and they're They can't get operating money.
Yeah.
And so, you know, let's be a little proactive and let's change before we're forced to change. I'm not a prophet, but it's not hard to predict. Whatever the percentage is, 50% of land is going to change ownership here in the next decade, something like that. I just made that number up, but I know it's and so we're going to either see further consolidation, or we can make viable businesses so more family farmers can stay on the land and it can be transferred to the next generation. And so that's, you know, why at this last summit we called it the Regenerative Legacy Summit. We got to be regenerative, profitable, and build a legacy business, because the next guy, he may or may not care about all the work that we've done to regenerate the soil, and you know, all the work that all the carbon that we sequestered over the decades could be gone and in days, literally, you know, through tillage and management practices that work in an adversarial way towards what we've done. So
Well, I like that, the name of your podcast is The Profitable Steward, and I think
yeah.
you've touched on it a bunch of times here is the, we can talk about stewardship, and I think a lot of people maybe even get a little bit of, I don't know, kind of bad taste in their mouth when they think about land management, soil, like that's kind of the hippie soil manager. That's all great, and sure we could do that, but at the end of the day, we need to make money and be profitable, and you've tied those two together. In profitable stewardship and it's important to recognize that they really can go hand in hand and teach that to the next generation, like you say, so they don't come in and just immediately, well, just jump off the bandwagon and till it up or do whatever, you just start managing poorly and degrading it for their perceived profitability, or with some sort of a perception of that being a profitable decision. But tying linking those two together is going to be important, and recognizing that good management, good stewardship of land is essential for long-term profitability.
Yeah, it is. And so from that name, you know, the profitable steward, it comes from a biblical standpoint. But also, as you've mentioned, I believe that profitability is an important part of stewardship. And so we can't be good stewards if we're not profitable at the same time. We can't be regenerative if we're not profitable. So and what does profitable mean? I mean, it's more than just the black at the bottom of your P&L. You know, or a positive number at the bottom of your P&L. I think we need to look at it from a quality of life standpoint. And if we're truly looking at it holistically, I know that no banker is going to necessarily, well, maybe now that you can monetize your carbon, but you know, our ecological scores beyond our balance sheets. Those are the things that, you know, we were working towards with our company, is being able to bring that balance in where those that are providing the finance have a stake in the game, not just to get paid back with interest, but also to be able to help the land to be regenerative in a profitable way. And I think that's pretty exciting to see that, you know, there are non-traditional lenders out there who are willing to invest at cause. They still want a return, but it's a partnership rather than a contractual relationship.
What do you see, like, I mean, how people monetize their management? I mean, you talked about carbon there. Yeah, there's premium products potentially in like the food markets and stuff. I mean, is what how do you see do you see other creative ways that people can monetize good management?
I think through being good managers, the results will speak for themselves. And so, you know, we all know that, you know, the Gabe Browns and Joel Salatins and people, they're offered land to be able to lease, because of their proven
That's a
track
good point.
record. And so, to me, that's keep the free market system alive and vibrant. Keep the government out as much as possible. And so I'm not a proponent of, like, you know, the programs that reward stewardship or regeneration or things like that. I think that, and the carbon side is a hard one for me, maybe I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth here, and because I know it is a government mandated program, but at least the way I justify it is the money doesn't pass through the hands of the government. It's directly from companies to us. And so while there is a level of government oversight, there is also in banking and so forth too. So where do you draw the line?
So you mentioned that one. I've wondered the same thing. You mentioned government mandated. Is it mandated or just kind of regulated?
I guess probably regulated at this point, right?
Okay.
Yeah, not mandate. That's too strong of a word.
Yeah.
But
well, when I
potentially
think
will be.
Yeah, potentially. But that's where, and I've wondered too, like I have mixed feelings on it as well. But the idea of it being some sort of a free market, sort of free market type thing, and that companies are buying it because their customers demand a certain level of, you know, that kind of decision making. They want to see sustainable choices and whatnot, so they're purchasing it out of free will and paying farmers who manage in a certain way. Like, I kind of like that way of monetizing it. But that being said, I also am skeptical about the carbon markets, because it seems like everybody's in it just to make a buck. The farmer wants to get paid, and they'll, whether they manage truly in a way that improves soil, or they're just checking boxes, you know, doing the minimum to get the payment. And then there's the middlemen trying to make their payment. And then there's the company buying them is just doing it because they need to make money, and that's what their customers are demanding. And it's a struggle to me when I see everybody in it just trying to make a buck out of it. And is any of their focus really on the soil? But it's a step in the right direction, I guess, maybe. So
we hope so, right? Yeah,
yeah.
That's what we hope. And so far, working with the company that we are, it's been good. They definitely have a regenerative aspect to it, in that, you know, the grazing needs to be managed in such a way that you are showing improvement over time. And so layering that with what we're doing with Savory Institute and long-term monitoring, it would be great if they would marry and we could just do one form of monitoring. But right now it's somewhat duplicated, but so it's certainly not the best. I think it will evolve, and we hope that it will evolve, then stay in the free market side and not be mandated and government over-regulated.
I just realized I'm not sure if I gave you the opportunity to fully answer the question and kind of your enterprise choice as we kind of dove into the direct marketing. Do you want to talk a little more? And I forget now what we even talked about before we dove into the direct marketing, on your enterprise choices and your transitions from sheep to cows to stock or custom grazers and whatnot.
Yeah. So just kind of to back up, you know, I was partnered with my my dad, and I think we decided to sell the sheep when I was about 16 years old. And so I remember my dad and my grandpa and I just sitting around having a very informal business meeting, and it was like, well, you know, the sheep aren't profitable. Should we sell them? And I'm sure it was a lot more in methodical conversation for my dad, but the decision was made, yes, we need to sell. And I have drawn back on that a lot. When something doesn't work, we don't have to beat a dead horse and try to make it work. Granted, there have been people who have been profitable in the sheep business, but just because they are doesn't mean that you can be. And so that's kind of my rule of thumb with an enterprise is, you know, everybody wants to start direct marketing, and I've probably swayed more people away from it in consulting with them because I know the work that is involved, and I know it's not necessarily a silver bullet. And so we go back to, like, really, what is your, I mean, if you are passionate about working with people and you're a good relationship person, let's do that. If not, find somebody who is and can do your marketing for you, and you do what's best, which probably is producing beef. You're really good at that.
Yeah.
But don't try to be everything to everyone. And
sure.
So along the way, you know, we tried sheep paid for the ranch, sheep and wool. They were kind of, the rule of thumb was one of them paid for your expenses, the other one was profit. And then it got to the point where it wasn't. You know, the lambs weren't worth that much, and it cost more to shear them than the wool would bring. And so was like, okay, it's time to switch. We switched to cattle. The cow-calf enterprise worked for a long time. We had the capacity to run over 1,000 head without feeding them hay, usually 9 years out of 10. Occasionally we would get snowed out on our winter range. And then when that changed, we had to adapt. And so that's when we transitioned to custom grazing. And every year now with myself and those that I, myself and my adult son who's back on the ranch, you know, we hammer out numbers and we're like, man, you know, it's tough when our input costs increased by 30% last year. We're not this, I mean, custom grazing isn't cutting it. So what else do we do? You know, what other enterprises can we bring into the mix? And, I'm about diversification, but you know, if you look at the ranching for profit models and others, it's generally the most profitable ranches are the ones who hone in on what they're really good at.
Yeah.
And they focus on that. It's not doing like 10 different things. And usually it's saying no, is one of the biggest moves that we encourage people to make is like, stop doing things and focus. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be your leverage point. So, so right now it's custom grazing. We've tried goats. We've tried different species of, you know, grass finishing, which again is where our real passion is. The margins are best on the grass finished, critters even now with the high market. And you know, buying heiferettes and being able to finish them over the season, not having wintering cost into them. Those are just really good money makers for us, but getting them sold on the back end is kind of our weak link, the marketing weak link.
So that was what I was going to ask is kind of when you run those numbers on your grass finishers, do you look at that as selling them wholesale to a marketing company, even if it's your own marketing company, and then even then selling them wholesale, the numbers look good? Or is that including kind of direct to consumer, the full value, those numbers?
So back to the ranch, basically, we just use the opportunity cost. We might bump it up a little bit if they're pre-sold, but okay. Basically, you know what, whoever down the road would pay us for them as a, as a, you know, under 36 month old, getting a grade choice, decent carcass, hanging weight and things like that. So that's what we charge. And that's what the ranch gets paid, whether we sell it to whoever or we buy it ourselves. And then the marketing company, takes care of the marketing, processing can go either way. Sometimes the ranch pays for that. Sometimes the marketing company pays for that. But
yeah, so. That's awesome. Cool.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. So yeah, the scaling of that will be a challenge as you talked about finding a source for them, but no, that makes a lot of sense. And have you looked back at sheep again now? It seems like sheep look good on paper often. Has that been something you've revisited?
You know, we haven't, but I really appreciated what Roger Savory taught in our last summit, that he was kind of discouraging people jumping out and getting started with cattle, especially right now. And he said, you know, sheep and pigs are pretty good money makers. We know that we can run sheep. We don't have the winter range for them. And so we'd have to definitely change things up from the way we used to do them. But I do, you know, right now we're definitely not as diverse as we could be. But that's again going back to the who. And so as our kids grow up, we've encouraged them, man, you guys ought to really look at pigs and learn it while you're young. Maybe that is a resource that we can tap into, which doesn't conflict. Sheep, goats are definitely some good ones as well. But with again, being able to say no and recognize, okay, I can't do everything. Right now, until that person comes on board that's passionate about it and willing to learn, and has some skin in the game, we're kind of going to stick with what we have, which is the cattle side right now.
Yeah, no, and that makes sense. And I think you're absolutely right about the diversification. They talk about that too. I mean, really, when you're diverse in a bunch of them, like you're saying, a lot of times it's one or two enterprises generating the vast majority of the profit and kind of propping up the other ones that are losing money. And so, yeah, focusing in on what works well for you makes a lot of sense. But we're already here well over an hour. And so I want to give you the chance to plug everything that you're doing, and because there's a lot of good stuff you're putting out there. But before that, two questions, I guess. One is just, what haven't I asked you that you'd like to share or that you think would be worth sharing about your story or anything?
Yeah. along the way in this journey, you know, there's the human side of ranching, which we touch on a lot because you can YouTube and learn anything. You know, we've got guys that have become really good grazers because they YouTube it and they watch it and they go practice.
Mm-hmm.
The human side of ranching is the thing where I guess we kind of set ourselves apart a little bit. We at Ag Steward, we focus on building the steward while at the same time improving the stewardships, because I believe that there's a balance in there that if we focus just on the stewardships, meaning that, well, I need to run more cows or own more land or buy more equipment, those are the stewardships, or even have a bigger team, and we don't do that at the same time while we're growing the steward, things are out of balance and one or more of those stewardships will fall off that beam and that balance beam or that scale. And so how do we do that, I guess, is the question. And again, I don't have all the answers, but some of the things that we help our clients to do are the very things that we do. That's working on your key relationships. Like, I really love to work with husbands and wives that are committed. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes we will set the business on the shelf and we'll say, the business can fail, but your marriage can't. I mean, it can, but let's put the first things first here, right?
Yeah.
And let's focus on our family, our marriage relationship, sometimes even our health. You know, if you're dealing with migraine headaches and you sit down and you can't even think straight, how are you even going to write an email sequence, you know, to start marketing? Sometimes that's what we need to focus on. It's kind of looking for what the weak link is. And usually it's not the thing at the surface. Finances are a tough, hot topic right now, even with high commodity prices. You know, everybody wants to know how to be more profitable. I tend to look at, you know, profitability. Yeah, it's a function of all the things they talk about in Ranching for Profit and Savory Institute and having the right enterprise mix and things like that. But it's also, it comes down to, do you value yourself? Do you believe that what you do has value, and can you put that value, that energetic value, into the products that you sell?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you can do that, then the other part of it, you're still going to have to learn the skills. But the skills will come a lot easier. If you don't see yourself as having value through God's eyes, through your own eyes, how could you ask for people to give you money for the products that you sell? And so that's kind of the deeper level where we go, Jared, is always looking and asking those questions, those deeper questions of, like, we're not going to hack away at the leaves and the twigs and even the limbs. Sometimes we got to get to the roots. And so those things are, they're not as fun. Maybe they're not as easy to measure, but having been through situational depression, having experienced the trials of running a multi-generational, multi-million dollar business, it's like, even if things are working perfectly, there's the unseen things. And we've got to know. And the more vulnerable and honest that I've been, the more people have reached out and said, man, I'm glad I'm not alone. Especially as men, we just have this macho mentality that we just work harder, tough it up, rub some dirt in it and keep going. And, you know,
you think
there's
that's
a place
changing?
For that. But
do you think that's changing? It seems like it's becoming more normal for people in agriculture to start to think more about, I guess, mental health and things beyond just, like you said, that macho mentality.
I think as the generations change, that's probably what's helping things to change.
Sure. Yeah.
Like that older generation, older meaning that's probably me, you know, I'm going to be 50 this year.
Sure.
Those are things that, you know, you don't talk about emotions and feelings and stuff like that. And I think even with my dad's generation, it was even worse. My grandpa's generation, even worse. And so, it is good to see that it is changing. It's definitely it's definitely evolving, but I don't know if it's changing fast enough, you know, and we just did a podcast with some very vulnerable men, all of them ranchers, And we talked about, addiction, depression, suicide, and they individually, two of them came to me, and then the third one was invited. And I just applaud them that they were that vulnerable to, put that out there to the universe, and who knows where it's going to go. And but I'm grateful, and the messages and responses that I've gotten back have been positive. And so, it was a God-led thing that we knew we needed to do, and that's the only reason we were able to do it. And encourage people to go check that one out. It's one of the most recent ones. It's called Resilient Ranchers on our podcast channel, YouTube, and stuff. So.
I'm gonna again, give you the chance to plug all the stuff, but before that, what are like two, three, or four resource recommendations that have been super essential in your journey that you would think recommend people check out?
So Ranching for Profit School, they've been a great support to the industry. The Savory Institute, love what those guys are doing and up to. I wish that they were still combined because they complement each other. But people ask which one should I go to, and I just say both. It's just pick one this year, pick one next year, and do both. The Soil Health Consultants, really grateful for what those guys are doing from a soil health side and making it really focused on the profitability. And then I'll give a plug
Who
for,
is the soil health consultant? Is that like Understanding Ag or?
oh yeah, Understanding Ag.
Okay,
Yeah. So
sure.
I don't know which the Understanding Ag, I think, is the
Okay.
brand they use now. Soil Health,
Sure.
I don't know if that's a parent
Yeah,
company,
just one.
but
I
yeah.
wasn't
So
familiar with them, so that makes sense. Nope, good.
Gabe Brown and
Yes.
I think Ray's parted off now, but
Yeah.
Alan Williams and David Brandt, those
Yeah.
guys founded it. And I
Yeah.
appreciate, I've been to that school. Nicole Masters, super, super great and applicable. And then I'll give a plug for Josh Adams' company, the Living Soil Management. It's pretty small, somewhat regional right now, but as far as being able to ramp up forage production, so he's an alfalfa farmer, but been able to do it regeneratively. And even Gabe Brown questioned that because it's like, oh, that's a mining the soil and degenerate. And so how do you do that? And so check him out. He's got a
Cool.
podcast and also spoke on our summit back in January. Those are really good overviews of the, it
Awesome.
doesn't give you like a recipe, but it'd be like, okay, this is how it works. So those would probably be my top ones, Jared, right now.
Perfect.
And I guess I need to mention too, like, I'm bringing balance in. Like, not everything is production based. So I'm in two coaching groups. One is with Dan Sullivan, strategic coach. He's coached thousands of entrepreneurs. I joined that because I want to be around forward-thinking people and know that I need to grow my business, and that's going to help me to do that. And then another one is Dr. Benjamin Hardy, Rapid Transformation Group. I want to stay ahead of the people that we consult with, and so I'm very focused on my personal education and journey as well.
Well, then the last question for you is, where can people reach out? Where can they find all the different things you are putting out there? And talk about your book. I just was listening to a
Oh, yeah.
podcast here a few days ago with you and Tony Malmberg, I think, on your podcast, and he talked about your book, and I was like, I had no idea you had a book, so that's one I have to check out. So
So my book was written, it was published in 2020, and it was a labor of love. It is a novel, and it basically recaps our much of our journey up to that point of relationships, mental health, as well as bringing in some of the management of large scale ranches, and it's told in a story format. So I was able to condense a lot of the things that we've learned personally and through our mentors, and also through the interns and employees that have come through the ranch over the years, and consolidate that. So that book is called Searching for Home, Finding Grace. Searching for Home, Finding Grace. If you look for that title or Jared E. Sorensen on Amazon, that's the best way they print it and distribute it. And so again, I'm not but let them do what they do. As far as Ag Steward, really operable right now. We do just basically landing pages for the events that we do. So we're trying to keep consistent with the URLs. And so I know this next one, which will probably be after the podcast goes out, but Dallas Mont is going to be on our next one. We have those. The cadence that we're on is every second and fourth Thursday, we do a live webinar. We encourage people to jump on live. And then the recording goes on the YouTube channel and the audio goes on our podcast channel. And so the YouTube channel is the Profitable Ag Steward. And as you mentioned, the podcast is the Profitable Steward Podcast. And so we can, I can probably send you the link to that for a show notes. The next, again, legacy.agsteward.co. We've got two more summits scheduled for this year and encourage people to check that out. Those are free events. You can also access the recordings to those on our YouTube channel and encourage people to watch it there because you get to see the slides and things, its presentation. So we just bring in experts. And I share myself also on those about basically the theme of regeneration. And the last two have been on building legacy businesses that focus on businesses that outlast us and last for generations with really the long view in mind. So those would be the things our company is called Ag Steward. But yeah, the legacy Ag Steward would be a good one. We'll have the next summit up here soon, but if you register for that, you'll be plugged in and you'll get the emails and so forth for everything that we do.
Yeah. Lots of good stuff here. That's a lot to keep track of. I struggle with just getting a podcast out every week. So that's pretty incredible, but I really appreciate you coming on and doing this, Jared. I enjoyed our conversation. And so thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for what you're doing. This is awesome to be able to share the message and appreciate, you know, the work that you're doing on the podcast side, and you're in the trenches just like us, and that means a lot. So thanks, Jared.
The Herd Quitter Podcast is brought to you by Faro Cattle Company, whose mission is to help ranchers put more fun and profit into their business. You can get more information on Faro Cattle Company at farocattle.com. And if you enjoy what you've heard on this podcast, be sure to subscribe and check us out on Facebook and Instagram at Herd Quitter Podcast, or at herdquitterpodcast.com.